High in the sky, small white clouds scudded before the strong wind from the southwest. Their shadows raced across the bright green of new grass, across the strong, rich brown of plough furrows, the heavy horse teams drawing slow lines across the springtime fields. In between, the sun shone, hot and welcome on England emerging from its winter sleep. Emerging too, many said, from the long dark into a new day, a new spring under its young ruler and his iconoclastic but fortunate rule. In the marketplace of rustic Stamford, maybe as many as 2,000 people were gathered to witness the strange experiment that had been promised. The thanes and churls crowded in from the fields, wives and children with them, pushing back their hoods to take the sun, even shading their cloaks with due caution against the return of the spring showers. The slow, heavy faces showed pleasure, wonder, even excitement. For today someone would indeed show a new kind of courage that not even Ivar the Boneless or his brother Sigurd the Snake Eye might have matched. Today a man would leap from the great stone tower of the House of Wisdom itself and fly. Or so it was said. The crowd would be happy to see flight, to tell their children and grandchildren about it ever after, but they would be happy also to see dramatic fall. They munched bread and good blood sausage in even-tempered expectation of either. A blare of horns set the spectators moving slowly to either side of the square, as towards them from the king's great hall came the king himself and his guests and officers. At the head, walking with deliberate ceremonial just behind the troop of the champions, blasting challenge from their enormous, long-preserved auric horns, came the two kings themselves. Chef and his guest and partner, Saxon Alfred. Those who had not seen them before stared uncertainly at the contrasting figures, wondering, till their better-informed neighbours hissed the truth in their ears, which was the mighty one, which the tolerated partner. Indeed, it was Alfred who caught the eye, dressed like a king in scarlet cloak, sky-blue tunic, gold circlet on yellow hair, left hand resting easily on the gold hilt of an ancient sword. The man beside him wore scarlet also, a cloak of wool woven so fine it seemed as soft as its magnificent silk lining. But the tunic and breeches beneath it were plain dark grey. The king carried no sword, indeed no weapon at all, stalking along with his thumbs in his belt like a churl coming home from the plough. And yet, if one looked closer, it seemed possible that this was, after all, the man the Norse folk called Ivarsbarni, Sigurdbarni, the man who had killed both Ivar the Boneless and Sigurd the Snake Eye with his own hands, and King Kjarlik the Strong of the Swedes as well, had overthrown too the power of Charles the Bald and his Frankish horsemen at Hastings in the year of our Lord 866. The king was now in his late 20s, and he had the body of a swordsmith in his prime. Broad shoulders, powerful hands, a stride that swung from the hips, a waist so narrow he might have traded belts with his wife, if he had had one. Yet his face was that of a man much older. The black hair was streaked, and more than streaked with grey over the temples. More grey showed in the short, clipped beard. The king's right eye was covered with a plain black patch, but round it men could see the flesh drawn in, wasted, the one cheek hollow. Lines of care ran across his brow, an expression of constant pain. Or was it regret? Men said that he had returned from his duel with the last of the Ragnarssons, friendless and alone, having bought his life and his victory with the loss of others. Some said he had left his luck behind on the battlefield with his dead friends. Others, better informed, said that his luck was so great that he drained it from others, brought death to those who came too close.